Welcome to Bengals Scribe Session, presented by JosephOtto.com and Inquirer Sports. Here, your Bengals beat writers escort you inside the walls of Carl Brown Stadium to hear the news, analysis, and observations unfolding within the team from those documenting it daily. All with the sidecar of snark and absurdity you've come to expect. Let's go. We're about to start a party in here. He's made strong like a guitar in here. Looks like we got a good crowd in here. Turn it up, pretend and get lively.
Got it! The ball is out! The Bengals have scooped it up! Terrence Newman running back to the 30, 20, 10, 5, touchdown!
Up in the air. AJ Green makes the catch.
Oh man!
A deflected ball winds up in the hands of AJ Green and the clock hits zero.
It's about to get rowdy here, but if you want to fight, get out of here. We about to tear off the roof in here. We about to knock something loose in here.
All right, welcome to the latest edition of Scribe Session. Paul Daniel Jr. here with you. And the road trip continues, because as we go, and I don't have the second Bengals beat writer right now, I just go around the tri-state area and find people to talk to, anybody that'll pretty much listen to me at this point. So today I'm in the Loveland estate of one Paul Daugherty.
Nice to have you out here. This is terrific. How do you like my office, by the way?
It's a great office. It's a great office. You got the your when your Redskins were relevant, the Super Bowl from '83 poster up here.
John Riggins breaking a tackle to win the game.
Epic. I mean, do you just look at this and tear up now, knowing the shape that your young Redskins.
Yeah, not good. Certainly not the Rigo Redskins.
No, the Redskins today. I mean, they're a mess from Allen on down. And really, you could probably just start there. You could just start just with him.
It makes the Bengals look very, very good. I think they would look good without the comparison these days. But in comparison to the Snyders, yeah, you're really lucky to be a Bengal fan.
The Snyders are the anti-Bengals these days.
They really are.
They do everything the opposite.
Everything the opposite, including lose a lot.
It reminds, you know, it's all the Bengals fans that we get rage from when they lose in the playoffs 4 years in a row. The reminder of the other side is out there, okay?
That's right.
You can feel, if you like spending crazy in free agency and getting bonkers and making bad decisions and firing coaches immediately, you can find that. They play in the nation's capital and they don't win.
Don't you think, though, for the most part, most teams that go big in free agency are not successful teams? Teams that spend a lot of money on big-name players to win a press conference don't always win big in the real season.
They typically lose in the real season,
right,
if you go back and look to it. But we will get – I want to set some things up, because we will get to that earlier. Because this is our first podcast that we've done here, for our first Scribe Session since free agency concluded. We had the Bengals fairly active by their standards for the first week. Typically they won't start until about now. So you saw Clint Bowling was re-signed after he was sought after by a number of teams. You saw Ray Maluga re-signed. They put a second-round tender on Emmanuel Lemieux, learning from their mistake last year with Andrew Hawkins, where they put the low-round tender and ended up losing him to Cleveland. They signed A.J. Hawk, a guy who couldn't wait to get here after growing up in this area, and a nice depth piece in their linebacker room. And then the big fish, which came in on Sunday morning, which was Michael Johnson re-signing for 4 years and $20 million, and I want to kind of just start with Michael Johnson. We will get out to a column that you wrote in Tuesday's edition about the Bengals and the culture change, and it actually kind of maybe being cool to be a Bengal.
Yeah, how about that? Cool to be a Bengal.
Those days were fairly crazy to even talk about back in the day. And then I also, later on in the podcast, want to get into Chris Borland, who is from Dayton, a 24-year-old guy who broke out, was one of the stars of last year's draft class in San Francisco, said after a year and an offseason of talking with everyone he knows and concussion experts, he realized that he's walking away, and to walk away from what would have been huge contracts because of the way his career is headed. I think that's an interesting topic that we have to delve into. And I talked to Andrew Whitworth about that this morning. I'll have some of that audio. And also, I definitely want to talk to you about your book, which comes out officially today as we record on Tuesday afternoon.
Tonight, Joseph Best, 7 o'clock. Brookwood, yeah.
Be there, be square. It's an awesome story. I mean, people have kind of, I know a lot of people here have grown up reading about you and Jillian and your guys' relationship, and it's awesome. So I can't wait to get in. We'll get in all that. So we'll cover that whole gamut over this next hour. And so you now know what to expect. So let's delve in. Let's talk about Michael Johnson. What struck you? You know, you talked with John Thornton, and you talked to a number of people behind the scenes. What struck you about the fact that Michael Johnson wanted to come back here when you investigated this?
The culture change is just about complete, Paul. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've been here since 1988, so I remember the guys that they used to bring in. And all of them, without fail, had something dramatically wrong with them. Either they were old and over the hill and looking for one more paycheck, like Sam Adams, or they had a troubled past, like Terrell Owens, or they never were all that great in the first place, like a Michael Westbrook, or to me, a Lavernius Coles. This is a guy that not only wants to be here, but he wants to be here so much that he came back. Mm-hmm. To me, the significance beyond the athleticism and the way he'll help that rotation on the defensive line across the board is the fact that he'll come back here and he'll tell other guys who have the potential to leave here, listen, you know, explore your options, see what you can get. And I understand if you leave, but the grass isn't always greener. That's never been said around here.
No.
You know, over the years, you've had guys who couldn't wait to leave and would never have thought of coming back to Cincinnati, way back to Corey Dillon saying he'd rather flip burgers than be a Bengal. You can't say that anymore. I don't know that the Bengals are in the same league as New England or Seattle or Denver when it comes to getting free agents, mainly because they don't like to pay guys a lot of bonus money, guaranteed money. But they are certainly with Baltimore now, mm-hmm. and they're with Pittsburgh, and they're with Green Bay, and they're with teams that they're competing directly with in their division, and I think that's huge.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And you know, the reason that they're not, the biggest reason, you mentioned the guaranteed money, which is absolutely true, but they choose not to be with the New England's, the teams that, and New England actually doesn't spend a whole lot, but they can, and like they did with Darrelle Revis last year, if they feel like it fits them. But there's these teams that will go out there and spend huge amounts of money. They choose to just focus on keeping their own. And that's where I think the culture and the turnover has come from, is that people are now realizing, oh, I'll get every dime of my contract in Cincinnati. And you can't say that almost anywhere in the NFL. And that strategy is one of the primary reasons that Mike Johnson is back with the Bengals.
Yeah, John Thornton said as much to me yesterday. He said, you might be paid $60 million in Seattle and $40 million in Cincinnati, but over the length of the deal, you're probably going to make more money in Cincinnati because they're not going to cut you. Mm-hmm. They're not going to let you go. And I think you wrote about this, too, the loyalty here, the fact that Mike Brown has been a loyal guy and has rewarded guys with second contracts. There's a lot of second contracts in that locker room and a lot of appreciative guys and a lot of guys who have said, you know, Mike was loyal to me and he's been good to me. Maybe I should be loyal to him. And combine that with the fact that they win. I mean, they're not winning the way we'd like them to win,
yeah.
But they are winning. They have made the playoffs 4 years in a row. And it's a very, I think it's a very healthy situation where players from other places actually want to be.
Yeah, and players, when they leave here, want to come back, like Mike. I'm reminded of T.J. Houshmandzadeh, who regretted leaving because he went out and he came up in the Bengals system and just found it to be different when he went elsewhere. And the Bengals have changed even dramatically since then towards creating that loyalty. It's just such a weird thing in a league where everything is win now or it's over for you, and all that matters is guaranteed money, because that's the only thing that any player ever has as far as a guarantee in their life goes in the NFL. And the Bengals just live by a different code. I mean, and it's starting to pay off for them. I will say, though, you could not draw up a more ideal scenario for this first week to have fallen for the Bengals, in my opinion. There were a number of ways. Their number one need was a defensive line. Everybody knew that. They had to find a way to fix that because it wasn't going to fix itself in the draft at number 21. Free agency is the only way to go that it could happen. And they don't like spending big money on things that they don't trust. And free agency is inherently untrustworthy because a lot of guys get contracts and that they're done caring about playing hard because they got their contract. That's why they were in the league. Michael Johnson, you know you can trust. You know he fits your system. You know that he'll love Cincinnati. You know that he will be happy at work and want to play hard because he has friends here and that friends that made each other better. And to get that and get it at a bargain – and still then, and the best part of this is that they still get the compensatory pick in the third round that they lost, that they got because they lost him for a year, and he'll be on the team. I mean, you couldn't draw it up any better to spend this money on a guy in free agency that actually can be trusted. They just spent it on Nick Fairley. A guy from Detroit who is just who's looking for a payday, who's had weight problems and attitude problems and law problems, and you think that that would have been, you know, I heard a lot of fans, that'll be the big difference maker. No, that's the most. He's the anti Michael Johnson to fixing that problem.
Right.
This could not have really fallen better for the Bengals.
You know, it's ironic, and you and I talked about this last week. Was that I would not have written that column, that glowing, wonderful, praising column on the Bengals today, had they not gotten Michael Johnson. Right. Had he decided to go to Minnesota. And the interesting thing about that is, it wouldn't have. The culture would not have been different overnight than it is now, the same culture that we're praising. Nothing would have been different except Michael Johnson's decision. But you and I both know that had they not signed him, the offseason would have been a bust. Mm-hmm. It's great that they got A.J. Hawk, especially not knowing what Perfect's deal is. I think he was a very good acquisition. But like you said, he's a plug-in guy. Mm-hmm. It's nice that they re-signed Maulugan and especially Bowling. But they needed a pass rusher, and they got him. But had they not gotten Michael Johnson to come back, we wouldn't be sitting here talking about how great they are. We'd be saying, well, you know what, they did pretty well, but they didn't get a pass rusher.
But they screwed it up.
They screwed it up.
That's why I'm telling you, there wasn't a lot of good nights of sleep happening between Thursday and Sunday in Cincinnati. I think they felt that it made the most sense. They felt that Mike would want to come back to Cincinnati, but – you know, as you're sitting there and you don't, and Mike Zimmer's on the other end, they've seen Mike Zimmer win a lot of those. Mike Zimmer has brought a lot of guys to Cincinnati when he was here as defensive coordinator, and his pull is very strong. And when you're sitting there thinking that if Zim just made a great sell job and, you know, for whatever reason, they put some big offer out there and the Bengals didn't feel like they could match it and they really had to let Michael Johnson go, they would have rightfully had needed to be ripped because it was the one thing they had to solve. And so they sat there wondering the strength of taking care of the biggest problem with this team going forward was all hanging in the balance between that in that decision. And I think that's probably why it ended up being a 4-year deal, and rather than some 1-year reset type thing, where they said, "Hey, it's worth it. It's worth it. It makes too much sense."
How about the irony in Mike Zimmer being responsible for creating a lot of this culture, losing a guy that he wanted because of that culture?
Yeah, it's remarkable. I mean, yeah, it was quite an interesting web as it all unfolded, and I'm gonna have much more on that. As the week goes along, so check in for that at sustain.com. I want to talk a little about Michael Johnson's actual on-the-field effect. I mean, what he does in the community and what he does as far as in the locker room is, you know, can't be stated enough. Which, by the way, one of the coolest things was I'm going through just on Friday or Saturday, just looking through his charity site and just kind of perusing some general Michael Johnson stuff, and I come across him right behind Barack Obama at the march in Selma, where he's from Selma, Alabama. And so when they had the 50th anniversary across the bridge, there's the photo, all 6'7" of Michael Johnson, three rows behind Obama right there. I mean, In Selma, he has been a savior. The programs that he's done for kids in the schools back there have been amazing, and he's had programs similar like that here. I remember last year we were trying to meet up with Mike when we were going when the Bengals were in Tampa, and we were going to do it on Saturday when we flew in, but he's like, I can't because I'm bringing all of these kids from Selma to Tampa, and we're going to Busch Gardens to the amusement park together, and then they're coming to the game Sunday. It's like, that's just the kind of stuff this guy, I mean, that's what he's like. I don't, you know, does that win you games? I don't know if it wins you games, but I think it creates what you want to create in the locker room. But as far as on the field, there's a tangent there, but Wallace Gilberry, Carlos Dunlap, Margus Hunt, Will Clark are all better because of this, and in a long way better. I mean, Wallace Gilberry, if you look up, I know you're big into analytics and advanced stats.
Yeah, I'm really big into that. Yeah.
Really big, but the Pro Football Focus has this pass rush productivity analytic, how many pressures you get per pass rushing snap. Wallace's productivity was slightly down last year, not huge, not as much as you would think, but you can't deny he only had a sack and a half, and that came in the first game of the season. He wore down by playing too many snaps last year. He's perfect in the role behind Michael Johnson because he can slip inside on those pass rushing downs and play from the tackle position, where he's fantastic in there as well. If you were going to go into this season and Margus Hunt and Will Clark had to be stars,
right,
you felt like you were in a bad. So that's a lot of pressure to put on a guy, on two guys that haven't shown it, no matter how good you think they're going to be.
I think that the defensive line is a lot like a batting order. Mm-hmm. You know, every part depends on another part. You take Joey Votto out of the Reds lineup, you got guys in places trying to do things that they're not really capable of doing. Mm-hmm. With him back, that allows, like you said, Wallace can be that situational guy, which he's good at, instead of having to be the every down guy. Having Johnson back probably makes Dunlap better because they got to block Johnson. Like I said, it's sort of synergistic. You know, bringing him back not only adds him, but it makes everybody else better in different ways, kind of like a batting order does.
Yeah. And, you know, kind of like when the batting order's better and if they still don't hit, the hitting coach gets fired, right? Paul Gunther feeling the pressure now. There's no excuses. I mean, the last year, what happened after the season was Paul Gunther pretty blatantly to all of us said the players were not good enough. I mean, that was the message. It was Geno Atkins was just a guy. We need new personnel. You know, all these things, injuries, blah, blah, blah. That was how it was spelled out to us. So now, if those problems are fixed, and they have been, you have Michael Johnson, you're back in your rotation, you have your linebacker depth, you're still young, and you have emerging quality players at corner, you better be better than 22nd defensively, particularly that this is the same group that Mike Zimmer had 3 years in a row in the top seven. That pressure is definitely shifted onto him now that they seem to have the pieces in place, and it will even more so if however many players they add in the first 2 days of the draft,
right,
on the defensive side of the ball. It's only going to – I mean, the pieces are in place.
And with a couple of exceptions, Terrence Newman being one, Domantas Peko, it's not an old defense. Mm-hmm. It's got guys that are younger and coming into their prime, so there's another reason that they need to be a whole lot better than they were.
Yeah, I mean, you're talking about – If Leon Hall ends up the fourth corner next year, I mean, you have Adam Jones, who plays really young, and you have two recent first-round draft picks that would be your starting quarters. And,
right.
I mean, you know, there's a lot of questions as far as, you know, Bavontaze Burfict's knee and how a lot of things are going to play out. Will injuries pop back up? But for the most part, I think this week has reapplied the pressure to Paul Gunther that you need to have a top 10 defense, because that's what this team needs to win. I mean, when you have Andy Dalton, you better have one of the best defenses in football, and you better run the crap out of it.
Yep.
You know, because you're not going to win in thinking that he's Aaron Rodgers. I do want to do one thing real quick. I want to bring in some audio that we had from our conference call with Michael Johnson after he signed on Sunday. And you get kind of a good feel for his attitude. I think one of my favorite things he talked about, and I'll play this audio for him, was him talking about how he's not going to be number 93 again. He wants to be number 90 because he wants to be a different guy. He doesn't want to be, I'm going to recapture this glory of who I was. I think he feels really re-energized by his year away in Tampa Bay. So here's a little bit of Michael Johnson from his conference call for signing on Sunday.
Did this always kind of make the most sense for you, the idea? I mean, if you did get released from Tampa, was it always kind of in your head that this would just make too much sense not to end up back here?
Well, I think it made sense. You know, and don't get me wrong, I wanted things to work out in Tampa. It's just unfortunate the way, you know, it's still here. And anytime you sign a big deal like that, you know, that's always a possibility. You know, you want to make your best year, the first year, your best year, and you go from there. But that wasn't the case. And you know, I was prepared to go out and have the best season of my career this upcoming year. So now I should be going out to Cincinnati.
Michael, this is Kevin Gohe from Fox Sports Ohio. Hey, what have you learned through this whole experience, just from this point last year to now?
I really, you know, learned about a lot about myself. You know, like what makes me happy, and how important just being happy, you know, is to, you know, overall just health. You know what I'm saying? And relationships are important to me. I've had a lot of great relationships throughout my life with different people, and have been placed in my life for different reasons, and I've learned a lot of things. And you know, I've grown a lot. This last year was a character building year. I don't want to call it a bad year. It was a character building year, and so I come back to Cincinnati with a different mindset, different outlook on things, and I'm just overjoyed that I had an opportunity. Like, really, like, who gets an opportunity to do what I should become? You know, that's amazing, man. And, you know, I'm thankful for the Buccaneers giving me an opportunity to come down there and learn and have some great coaches and some great players as well to watch and learn from. So, sometimes it's good to be able to step away and get a different experience. You know, and see what you can learn and grow. And I'm going to always cherish all the memories, you know, the highs and the lows. Because, you know, you can't appreciate the highs without the lows.
It's Michael, obviously last year wasn't the year you wanted to be. Geno Atkins also didn't have the kind of year everybody's used to seeing Geno, and he's coming back off an injury. Do you think, you know, as much success as your defensive line had when all you guys were all together, Is it possible to recapture that?
Oh, we're going to get that ass on. You know what I'm saying? We've all had the opportunity. Well, I had the opportunity to go out, you know what I'm saying, and do something different. And they've had the opportunity to do something different as well. And I feel like everybody knows that, you know, we play well together. I mean, it's just, you know, I don't know why. We just do. We got that chemistry, that bond. You know, we chase each other in the group right now, making jokes and laughing at that. That's what makes, I think that's what makes, you know, that's what makes things go like that. When you got that relationship with somebody off the field, or, you know, you care about them and care about you, and y'all just like brothers, man. Like, you know, you go to bat for each other. Like, it's, unless you've been a part of something like that, it's really kind of hard to understand, you know.
So are you going to try to get 93 back? Is there going to be a deal made with Will Clark? Or?
Nah, that's his number. He can have it. I'm aging 90. I'm not the guy that left. I'm coming back. I'm going to be better.
So we have Michael Johnson now in the fold, and we kind of got into the culture change a little bit. But I want to talk about an aspect of it that I loved, a stat that I saw where people were talking about this in regards to Green Bay. Did you know Green Bay has only one single player on their team that has played for another team?
Wow.
Yeah. So a free agent.
Yeah, I did read that somewhere.
Julius Peppers, who they sprung for last year and shocked every beat writer in Green Bay. It's the first time they've ever really done it because they felt like it was their time, and it, you could argue, should have been last year. But so the Bengals, the Bengals and Green Bay use the exact same concept of team development, except one of them has number 12 and one of them has number 14. So there's a little, that's the difference in success pretty much. But, and if you look at the Bengals, their top 10, as far as cap hits, players that make the most money on the Bengals, all have not played for another team. They all are guys that have been developed here or are about to sign a contract. And that number is only going to grow considering that they have a ton of guys that are up for their first contracts that will get extensions in the next year. You could have next year, you could have your top 15 or 20 will all be that way. Only Reggie Nelson in the top 15 cap hits is a guy that's played for another team. I mean, that this strategy works. It comes for the around the third or fourth day of free agency, Bengals fans lose their mind every year because they don't think that they're spending enough and blah, blah, blah. They didn't go out and be active. But it just proves over and over, this strategy of drafting, developing, and extending is the best way to assure you don't have problems of guys like we talked about that sign a deal and stop playing.
Right. You have to add the asterisk of you better know what you're doing when you draft. When
right.
You scout and you draft, you better pick the right guys. Otherwise, if you don't, which we saw back in the 90s, if you don't pick the right guys and you still keep those guys, you're still going to keep going 4-12 every year.
Yeah. Yeah. And bad draft. And that's the other aspect of it. And I've been saying this, I think I may have said this on every podcast since the season ended, which is that if you have a quarterback like Andy Dalton, you can't whiff on a draft. And you can get away with it if you have Tom Brady or right. Peyton Manning, whatever. You can get away with some of the other drafts not panning out and, you know, they all wash out. If you have Andy Dalton and you have one of these middle on down quarterbacks, if you don't have one of the top 10, you cannot have a draft where you get one starter out of it. You have to hit, and they've hit, and they have. In the last, it's been the difference just 4 year run is they've hit every draft, which is a tribute to Duke Tobin and his staff and all the coaches that are part of the scouting there. Another aspect of this that we briefly touched on earlier, but I want to bring it to me, the prime example of the Bengals' philosophy working and creating that culture of trust amongst players and players wanting to come here is Leon Hall. Leon Hall would have been cut or restructured by 31 other teams this year. He is a $7.8 million cap hit on a guy who has had two Achilles surgeries and last year showed it. He was looked right. slower. He was not the same guy. But this team saw Leon Hall work so hard for them in coming back from the first one, and they believe in him so much as a person and as a part of this team that they are not going to take one dime away from him by restructuring a deal right. and trying to push something forward or cutting him and trying to re-sign him for cheaper. That's the deal they signed. They believe in him, and they're going to believe him to the end, even if it means that they're going to lose out on extending a guy here or whatever, because that's what's important. And players around the league, I think, like we said, are starting to notice things like that. I mean, I get every day, why doesn't Leon Hall get cut? Why don't they restructure? Because it's just not the way that they choose to operate.
You're right, but players around the league might notice it, but the players within the locker room definitely do.
Definitely.
And I think that's part of creating this culture that we're talking about.
Yeah, it's why you keep it the same. I want to bring in A.J. Hawk, who we talked to last week. And, I mean, here's another one of a guy who has a friend in Mike Nugent that he's known since he was playing with him in high school and played with him in college, and now they're going to play together again for the first time, who gave him the download that you're not going to believe how great this locker room is, and that's why coming here, on top of the fact that he grew up here and gone to Riverfront Stadium back in the days when they were bad, was a dream for him. So I want to bring in a little bit of us talking with AJ Hawk, which I think is a perfect example of the ideal type of free agent complimentary piece signing for a number of reasons, but the words that he said are a big reason why. So here's AJ Hawk from after he signed last week.
100%. This was my now that I'm officially here, I can say it was definitely my first choice. It was almost like thinking, hopefully, maybe if that would ever work out someday, it'd be awesome to go back to Cincinnati. But I never really thought it would be a reality. So when the opportunity came, this was 100% my first choice. And anyone in my close family knew that. My wife and I had talked about it. It's weird that it's a reality now. It's exciting for sure. I can't wait to get started. Just being here and hearing people even say I'm on the Bengals is weird. It feels weird because I was a little kid growing up to Riverfront Stadium. So, yeah, this is great.
You said you are older in this linebacking corps. I think people want to know, how many good years does AJ Hawk have left in his career?
Who knows? I get asked that a lot. I couldn't tell you. I want to play as long as I can, as long as I feel like I'm still contribute and mentally there. My head feels great. I've been very lucky when it comes to that, with injuries and everything. So do the best I can to take care of myself physically and mentally. And I don't know, it's hard to put like a number on that because I love playing. I'm passionate about it. So as long as that's there, I'm going to try to give it a shot.
It's kind of a cool story that AJ Hawk was just hanging out in Riverfront Stadium as a kid and always kept his eye on wanting to come here. He's an idol. I mean, he's an idol in Green Bay. They love him up there. He's their all-time tackler. But that he just, as soon as he came on the market, it was Cincinnati 100%, and everybody in his family would tell you that's where he's going to end up, and really no one else was even a competitor. I mean, imagine that in 1990 anything.
Well, yeah, right. Now how good a player can he still be, do you think?
He has a year in him. He has maybe two, which was what they gave him. I mean, to me, he played well the first half of last season. You see this amongst a lot of guys as they start to get wear and tear. It's when they're still asked to do what they previously did. If you use him in a role like the Bengals plan on using him, where he is a guy that subs in special packages, maybe he plays a couple of games because someone's hurt with a hamstring pull or something like that. He can play every spot. And to me, that is, you play him 400 to 500 out of 1,100 total snaps on the season, that's ideal for AJ Hawk. And I think he can give you that. He has great instincts. He's still a good athlete. He's not completely slow out there. I mean, and the versatility he brings is great. If you think about it, who knows what Vontaze Burfict will bring, but let's just say Vontaze is playing, whether it's at a Pro Bowl level or not. You would have Vontaze Burfict, Ray Maluga, Emmanuel Emure, and then behind them have Vinny Ray and AJ Hawk, two guys who can play every position. I mean, that's taking care of the depth at a position where you clearly did not have it last year, because once Maluga and Burfict went down, the whole defense went down last year. And I think I don't think there's any doubt that he provides a lot of help in that manner.
Good.
They have to. Let's flip it forward. I'll talk a little bit of bigger picture here. I want to talk about Chris Borland, who at 24 retired and now is maybe what a lot of people are using the word game changer for the NFL, and I don't know if it is, but the players and the NFLPA have been stressing to players as they come in education on this issue. But I don't know that hits home with anybody. It's still, we'll be educated so we know what to expect. It's not, we'll be educated so we might leave multi-millions of dollars on the table. Do you, in your mind, do you think this will change? Could be that moment that we look back on in 10 years and say, that's when this whole thing changed?
No, I don't think it's going to be one watershed moment. I think rather it's going to be a collection of moments, a collection of Borlands, of guys leaving early, making a decision that their health is more important than the money. And frankly, why wouldn't it be given the money that these guys make? I don't know about you, but if somebody handed me a check for $7 or $8 million, I would say, see you later. I'm going to go do what I want to do instead of what I have to do. Mm-hmm. I don't think the decision at least from a financial standpoint, is all that difficult. That said, professional athletes are different birds, and they live to compete, and that's all they've ever known. And the longer they do it, the harder it is to adjust. So he won't have that tough an adjustment. But to answer your question, I don't think so. I think it's just another brick in the wall that eventually will be a pretty big wall. Back to Michael Johnson, he took himself out, if you recall. He had a concussion, it was a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
And he just said, you know, I'm not going to go. I'm not ready to go. And I thought that was the smart thing to do. And I think more and more, as people get educated and as they see the results, the sad results of these guys when they're 50 and 60 years old, you know, essentially remember their cars and forget their keys or vice versa. Tony Dorsett taking his daughter someplace and not remember where he's going while he's driving. I think that eventually the trickle will become a flood.
Yeah, and really the effect, and this is the NFL's worst nightmare. They are the strongest sports league maybe in history in this country because of where they're at. I mean, where they're at, it's as strong as it'll ever be. But the only thing that can really take it down is this, in my opinion. There's the upward trend will continue to go on unless your talent pool disintegrates. So the same problem people have with USA soccer and why they're not as good is because the talent pool is smaller because the best athletes don't play it. Well, if the best athletes stop playing football because they're being steered away from it because of what they hear about guys like this, your product disintegrates. And you're no longer what you were. Now I think people will always want to go watch. I don't think that it's dying at all. But I mean, this is the type of stuff that will change if this continues. I don't know how many Chris Borlands we'll see. I mean,
it would take a high profile guy to do what he's doing at a young age to say enough is enough. I value my health more than the money, and you know nobody outside of Chris Borland's household really knows who Chris Borland is, other than you, of course.
Yes, of course.
But I think it would take a big name guy to do something like that for it to have a profound impact. And I, you know, honestly, Paul, I'm still skeptical of the whole notion that this concussion thing is going to harm this league substantially, simply because a lot of players in this league come from humble beginnings, and their families depend on them. They're the breadwinner. They're going to pull us through whatever problems we might have. I don't think that's going to change. I still think you're going to see mom and pop or whoever have these kids out there playing Pop Warner at age 7. And if they're really good, keep pushing them through college and into the pros because they see them as the pot of gold. And these kids see it as a pot of gold. And if not everybody in this country, you know, is soccer mom and dad driving to the fields in a minivan on Saturday afternoons, you know, this is serious business for a lot of these kids and a lot of the really good players. So until that changes, I have a hard time seeing the popularity of this game changing.
But could it change? Here's where I think it could change, though. Is the socioeconomic cross-section of who plays the game, whereas people point to boxing a lot, where boxing became it was a lot of people trying to rise to the next level economically for their entire families, whereas maybe you're the football players that previously did come from mom and pop driving, you know, the minivans around, maybe you see less of that. Maybe you see less of the well-off families where the football players come from, and maybe it's more of the lower income, the middle class on down is where it comes from because they feel like, well, I'm not in jeopardy of not being able to, you know, make a living for the rest of my life. That's not in jeopardy, and they feel safer to make that decision.
No, you're right. Either way, as you said, the talent pool diminishes, and the quality of the game diminishes, and maybe at some time in my opinion, the distant future, the popularity of the game diminishes. But it's really hard to look at it now. We've had, you know, how many years has it been since we've had the information on the concussions and the CTE and the damage that's been done to these former players? It's been several years, and the popularity of the league only goes up.
Yeah.
So until it's sort of like global warming. Until I see the ocean in Columbia, South Carolina, You know, I'm not entirely convinced, although I should be, but I'm not. Until I see the popularity of the game diminishing even slightly, I'm not convinced that, that the CTE, the concussion issue, is going to have that big an effect.
Yeah. Every year a new topic seems to attempt to – it's the one that's going to bring the NFL down.
Right.
This year it was the domestic violence stuff. The previous year it was the bullying, and concussions have been a part of it the whole time. But you're right. But then the ratings are higher than they were the previous year, and the contracts get bigger, and the salary cap goes up, and it just continues. And the more money that can be made by playing this game, the more people are just going to do it.
I guess it can be chipped away at. It's not as if, you know, Southern California is going to fall into the ocean one day because they have a mudslide, a typhoon, and raging fires all on the same day. Mm. I guess, you know, sort of a gradual chipping away at the popularity of the game through various means may lead to its downfall, like the Roman Empire or something. But like I said, given the popularity now, the insane popularity, to me, irrational popularity, it's hard to see it going down the tubes in our lifetimes.
Yeah, a guy in the Bengals locker room who's incredibly well-versed on this topic and the whole concept of concussions and making players aware is Andrew Whitworth, who has been the head of he's been their NFLPA rep for a number of years. He actually just recently stepped down. And he has been a big part of trying to push education. And I talked to him this morning about this topic and if this maybe could be something that changes the game. And his opinion was, I think this could be a great thing in that it changes the conversation and allows guys to actually be more educated. I want to bring in some of my interview with Andrew Whitworth. He was back actually home in Louisiana for a few days. So this was a little bit of my conversation with Andrew Whitworth on this topic.
It's sort of a game changer, or maybe not?
I think a game changer in the sense that I think it could actually be good for the game. I just shared this on Twitter, but the truth of the matter is that this is a violent, physical, risky game, and you're making a business decision when you choose to get paid money to play it. And I think it's important for kids who are growing up wanting to play this game at this level. They need to understand that and respect it. I mean, it is what it is. There's a lot of injuries that are involved in this game. You watch the IR list every year. There's a ton of people on it. And so I think people are just starting to be more aware of all the things that go into it. And if you don't see, oh, man, this is really going to alter my life money-wise or money's going to support me, then you better be playing it for the right reasons because injuries are just a guarantee. And so, I think you have to respect both decisions, the business decision to play and the business decision to not play. And I think that's what's important. And if it makes more kids understand that and respect it, then I think that's a good thing.
Yeah, it seems like that it really is it. I mean, is that now maybe more guys can open their eyes to the guys coming into the league to see both sides of it a little more, whereas before, I don't think there was ever anybody that has walked away like that, where people would say, "Oh, maybe that's an option."
You see the criticism all the time of kids coming in the league and not understanding the value of making money or understanding that what they do is a privilege, those kind of things. So I think it's real important for people to see this and go, "Man, look, this is the evolution of the NFL player. The NFL player is no longer someone who has always had this persona and unjustly, in my opinion, but of being uneducated or just a meathead, just kind of a football player. Guys are making true business decisions. They're saying, hey, based off of where I am in my life and what I want to achieve, is the money worth it? Is, playing this game worth it? I mean, to me, that shows you that the new NFL football player and what we kind of evolved to and come into is that, guys are making decisions that are best educationally and for their family and all those things. And I think that's something to be respected. And I think it's something to be commended. So, I respect the guys that play it, and I respect guys like Orland who decided it's not for them.
All right. We've run the gamut. I mean, we've touched on it. We've solved all the, we got all the Bengals problems figured out. We figured out the NFL's concussion issues and covered it all. Let's talk about your book.
Okay, go ahead.
I'm excited to talk about this because, as you know, Jillian and I are best friends.
Yeah, she loves you.
I love it because after every Beyond the Stripes show, she makes sure to say hello to me before, and we always talk afterwards. And if I wasn't going to be on my honeymoon, she told me I was coming to the wedding on the 27th.
Yes.
I'm sure her and my fiance could talk for long hours about wedding plans. I'm pretty sure they did after many Beyond the Stripes this year. Your book, An Uncomplicated Life, A Father's Memoir of His Exceptional Daughter, as I mentioned, comes out today. And when did you I'm curious, really, when you decided you wanted to write this book?
After many years, Paul, of people telling me that I should. I never thought of Jillian as a book. I'd write about her occasionally in a newspaper, some triumph that she might have had or goofy thing that she might have done. And people, I get far more response to columns about Jillian or my son Kelly than I get about sports stuff. That might say a whole lot about my ability as a sports columnist. But I never considered her a book subject until people said she is. And in doing the research for the book and in talking to lots of people who had touched Jillian's life, I found out that she had touched theirs too. It became more of a story about how to be a good person, how to be a good guy, in essence, than about Jillian's disability. Jillian is the finest human being I've ever met. And I don't say that simply because she's my daughter. I say it because it's true. She kind of possesses all the attributes that you want from a friend or a child or a husband or a wife or whatever, a father, mother. You know, she's kind and she has no agenda. She has no guile. She's generous. She's empathetic. She's sympathetic. She's all the things that we really want people to be, but never really are, myself included. So, a long answer, short question. People suggested I should write the book. I was skeptical at first, and once I started looking into it, I realized, yeah, maybe they're right. Maybe there's a story here that everybody can learn something from, whether they have a child with a disability or not.
Yeah, that's one of my favorite things in being around Jillian is that I always feel better after talking to you. It's always enlightening. It's the huge smile and the positive attitude about everything. You're always just come away saying, "Man, I feel great." Finding that in any person is so challenging. Were there hard elements to writing this book for you, or was it all pretty easy because it was a topic that is so personal to you?
Well, the hardest thing for me was remembering, and yeah. I'm really grateful to Jillian and my wife that they have good memories. And my wife even wrote some of the stuff down. And had I done that over the years, I'd have been a lot better off. That was the hardest part. In terms of emotionally, I'd written for the paper a lot of the stuff that is in the book, not with the depth that's in the book, but you know, surface kind of stuff. And it was emotional writing that the first time, you know, Jillian's first day of school, the last day that Jillian wanted me to walk her down to the bus stop, the last day that I drove her to the Metro bus stop before she got her own apartment, which was within walking distance of the Metro bus stop. Those were all in the paper and they were emotional at that time. By the time I got them into the book, I'd already done that, you know, mm-hmm. already done the shed the tears. So it was more like, boy, I've got a deadline here and I've got to crank this out and I need to make it as good as I can make it. More so that emotion than the crying kind of emotion.
Yeah. Doll, you will be a ball of tears on June 27th.
Though. I will be a puddle on the floor, man. I'll be the wicked witch. You know, I'm melting. It's gonna be it's gonna be great and awful at the same time.
Yeah, it's gonna be fantastic. Well, congratulations on finishing the book. I don't know if you know this, but I actually purchased your Chad Johnson book.
Yes. You were the one.
I was the one. I think I still have it somewhere. How many books is this for you?
This is the fourth book.
Fourth book.
Yeah.
Man, that's fantastic. Is writing a book as hard as you would think it is?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. This one was hard because The style of writing is completely different from writing a column. A column is 700 words, get in, get out, make your point, see you later, let's do it again tomorrow. Writing books is 3,500 words per chapter, and you have to keep a flow going. And because of what I do, I don't have time to sit down and spend 6 months writing a book.
Yeah.
This book took more than 4 years simply because I just didn't have the time to devote to it. So that part was really hard, making sure you continue the flow, that you segue comfortably from one chapter to the next, and all your thoughts are together, and that you just have the time, finding the time. I don't know how people who have full-time jobs are able to write as many books as they do. It amazes me, because the effort required to do both, the mental energy required to do both is really, at least for me, it was really difficult.
I've always had that out there, something that at some point I want to do. I've always wanted to write a book, but it's that idea of such a daunting task when you're standing there on day one thinking, oh my God, the concept of filling all these pages.
Yeah. It's the other books, the book I did on Chad and the one I did with Johnny Bench and the other was a collection. They weren't that difficult. The Chad book was not hard. The Johnny book was really not hard. The Jillian book was a different thing entirely, because it's about two or three times as long as those books and required lots of interviews and lots of time and time that I never really had. And you're right. The hardest thing is making the time, finding the time, and not worrying about how much more you have to go. It's kind of like how we raised Jillian. You do it one day at a time. You don't worry about what happened yesterday, and you don't think about what could happen tomorrow. All you can do is what's right in front of you, and that's kind of how I approach the book.
Yeah. What's your favorite book?
Oh, boy. I had somebody ask me that the other day. I have several. And people are going to laugh. My favorite book was The Prince of Tides, Pat Conroy's book.
Yeah.
I love Pat Conroy. He's a Southern romantic. And his way with words is amazing. And The Prince of Tides was far and away his best work. A lot of critics thought it was kind of goopy, you know, kind of saccharine, sugary and overdone. And that might be true, but I kind of like goopy, saccharine, and overdone. So The Prince of Tides, was my favorite.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Mine is nowhere near as awesome and romantic like that. I love Jeff Perlman's book about the 86 Mets, The Bad Guys Won.
Yeah.
It's just great. It's just about complete debauchery behind the scenes.
I can remember that. I remember those guys.
Just fantastic. Wally Backman and everybody else on those teams, which
Strawberry, Gooden.
Oh, the team was just
Ray Knight.
Tim Tuffle. The team was just
Dykstra.
Dykstra.
Yeah, nut job.
Absolute nut job. I mean, it's just one of those where you couldn't put it down, because every page was more ridiculous than the last one, and all stuff that you never hear about, because all you read back in the day was box scores and things like game recaps. But now I should tell you, this is gonna be right up your alley. I mean, at the end of every podcast, I usually, especially when I have somebody on who I don't have on regularly, allow them to pick a song that I can put under as we try to take us out. Now, I know you're a big Van Morrison guy. Do you have a song in particular that you would like to go out to that maybe one of your favorites or something like that?
From Van?
Or any song that you would like. I'll open it up. You do whatever, any song that you feel like you want to do.
My favorite Desert Island One song that I never get tired of is Blue Sky. Allman Brothers.
Blue Sky by
you
the
You ever
Allman
heard
Brothers.
Of that?
I'm sure
youngster
I've heard
as
it.
You are.
No, I'm sure I actually liked Allman Brothers, but I don't, I don't know that I would know. I would know it if I heard it, probably. Like, oh yeah, I know this song, but actually hearing the title, I don't know that I it
yep.
doesn't.
Blue Sky.
Blue
Dickie
Sky
Betts on lead guitar.
All right. We'll bring in a little bit of the Allman Brothers. I like the Allman Brothers, though.
Oh,
I mean,
they're
great. And you taught me a lesson that Van Morrison is in fact a person and not a band this year.
Yeah, Paul, he's a person.
He's a person. I always thought he was that was the name of the band, but he was actually the guy.
He's the guy.
So I appreciate it. That was one of the great lessons that
whatever I can do for him musically, I'm happy to help.
Helping us.
I think the youngsters need educated musically anyway. So
I'm
here for you.
I'm here. We'll start doing a musical lessons podcast, or we'll chat every once a week. We'll have to have a talk where we just talk about music. music.
Works for me.
It's just all it is you just giving me lessons on different eras.
Right. I'm at your service.
I'm pretty strong musically. I feel like I know a lot about it. I'm open to it. I don't like country, but like love Led Zeppelin and the Who and all the and appreciate the oldies, mm-hmm. but really like a lot of different stuff and new school. But there are a lot. I got holes in my game, so maybe you can help me fill
that. I will, because I haven't really liked anybody since about 1975.
Well, that's it. I'll help you appreciate some of the new school.
All right,
and you'll
then.
Teach me some of the old school. This will work out perfect. All right, Doc. Again, congratulations on the book, and thanks for joining us. And hey, let's bring in the Allman Brothers here and let them take it out with one of Doc's favorites. So we'll talk to you next time on Scribe Session.